Day. Why would we be indoors on a fantastic day like that, like this? Because Father God's here, because it's good to be together, because there are things that we can do together that we can't do on our own, and all sorts of other good reasons like that. And I'd like to share with you some thoughts from the Bible with the theme of the Grand Archduke of York. And if you looked at the notice sheet, I hope you did, I do hope you wondered what on earth we're going to be talking about under the theme of the Grand Old Duke of York. And there was a hint where we'd actually put Mark 9 in brackets. And if you were that interested, you might even have had a look at Mark chapter 9 and tried to work out, and it shouldn't be all that difficult, should it really? But the Grand Old Duke of York, of course, is a song that we all know, a children's song. I'm really actually trying to follow Richard's idea of starting the talk with a song. But it's not quite the same, is it? I'm afraid I couldn't match his what he had. You could sing it, actually. Yes, I thought you could sing it if you like. But actually, this song is, at least I think, it's about somebody whose family trait seems to be trying to plant seabirds, put them in the ground and get a harvest back. And at least that's what plant seems to mean to me. But he's the father of Richard III. He lived in the 15th century. He fought in the Wars of the Roses. And this song, The Grand Old Duke of York, is thought to be about him and the Battle of Sandal Castle, part of the Battle of Wakefield. And he took his army to this stronghold on Sandal Castle, about 30-odd feet above the plains, and the Lancastrian army sort of came round and surrounded them. And he was in this stronghold, and he was fine. He marched his men up to the top of the hill. And then he had this crazy idea that he was going to attack the Lancastrian army, and he was outnumbered by about 10 to 1. But he came charging down the hill into this battle, and he led them down again. And unfortunately, didn't do very well. The battle kind of went against them, and so there was terrible confusion. And he shouted out, retreat, retreat. And they all turned around and started, and they had to climb all the way back up the hill to try to get away from the Lancastrian army behind them. They were all defeated, and unfortunately you might notice that the dates here of Richard Plantagenet end in 1460, and the battle was actually on the 30th of December 1460. He didn't make it. So that's actually what the song is about. If they'd stayed on the top of the hill, they'd have been okay. If they'd actually stayed down and fought, they probably would have been reasonably okay, at least they might have got out of it. But it's when they kind of turned around and weren't quite sure where they were that that they ended up in trouble. Now, we need to just sort of remember that. And I'd like to use that as either a metaphor or a simile or an analogy, or I really can't, it's one of those things, a sort of a comparison, if you like. And if we have that in mind, let's have a look at some of the things that are in the Bible and in Mark chapter 9. Now, Mark 9 is a parallel passage. What's in Mark 9 is also in Luke chapter 9, and it's also in Matthew chapter 17. So it's in the Bible three times. It's probably in there three times because it's important, because we really need to get the message of what's here three times in the Bible. So what's here? I'm going to show you it in Mark 9, but it's also what John read to us from Luke chapter 9. So for just a reinforcement or to remind us, this is an event that took place in Israel, somewhere around the northern part of the country. And Jesus took his three special disciples, the one who he had a slightly closer relationship with, up a mountain, and something amazing happened. And Jesus changed, looked completely different, transfigured before them. His garments became glistening, intensely white. And there appeared to them Elijah and Moses talking to Jesus. And Peter did his normal thing of sort of talking before thinking and said, let's build some tents. That wasn't really a brilliant thing to say. And then a cloud turned up and a voice said something. And they were absolutely amazed. Now that, to me, is quite an incredible story. I don't mean incredible in the sense that you can't believe it, but incredible in the sense that it's really unusual. And I'd like us just to kind of step through a few of the things that happened on the top of that mountain, and just understand what was going on and try and imagine ourselves in that place. It's a passage that we refer to as the Transfiguration. Slightly different details in Matthew, Mark and Luke, but repeated there three times because it's important. What did actually happen when Jesus took his three friends up the mountain? Well, the first thing is that Jesus changed. He didn't look the same on the top of the mountain as he did on the way up, on the way down, or when they were down in the valley. There was something different, and it was very dramatically different. First of all, we have the word transfigured. And the Greek word, Ben would have recognized from his biology lessons, because the Greek word is metamorphosis. It's a word that we perhaps might remember from school days. Metamorphosis is what happens to insects, well, some insects anyway. And we think of caterpillars and butterflies as the sort of epitome, the best example of metamorphosis that we're all familiar with. Metamorphosis means different body. The same organism, the same creature, the same thing, but with a different body. The amazing thing is that a butterfly is actually a caterpillar. That's the amazing thing about metamorphosis of that particular creature, that it's the same thing grubbing around on the ground that sort of looks boring and very sort of two-dimensional, you know, it goes forwards and backwards and sideways, to this amazing, colourful thing that flies around, a butterfly. And somehow they are actually the same. It is the same creature. And if you could imagine what Peter and James and John might have thought when their friend Jesus, who they'd known for a year or so, and they'd been walking around, and suddenly this happens before their very eyes. They see this person, this ordinary person they know, turn into something completely different. Of course, we've got the advantage of films and television and CGI, computer-generated imagery and that sort of thing. We could probably imagine what that looked like. And there are certainly films where, you know, that people turn into other things. But they would never have seen that, never have thought of that. It would have been completely unexpected, and yet it happened. It was a different body, but it was different appearance, but it was the same Jesus. And the interesting thing that I think is that this amazing thing actually happened in front of them. It says in the Bible it was before their very eyes. It was a real event. It wasn't that they were asleep and dreaming. It wasn't some sort of mystical appearance, you know, that they kind of saw but didn't really see. They actually saw it. And Mark chapter 9, verse 9 says they were talking about, when they came down the mountain, what they had seen. They actually saw this with their very eyes. It really happened. It wasn't some sort of picture. And what actually happened was that an ordinary person wearing ordinary sort of dusty clothes just kind of glowed with a light that was very, very difficult to look at. It says in Matthew that the face of Jesus shone like the sun, which you can't look at. His garments became intensely white as light. This wasn't just a kind of a Daz experience, you know. It was, or Purcell, or whatever you happen to use. It was just incredible. The word that's used here in Mark for glistening, it was kind of flashing and strobing, and it was, you know, incredibly bright. What an amazing thing. What on earth was going on here? What actually happened when this person, Jesus, who they'd been walking around, who looked, you know, who was, he didn't just look like, he was an ordinary human being, flesh and blood. He ate and drank and slept and went to the toilet and did all ordinary things that we do. And suddenly, he turned into something else. What actually was going on that mountaintop? And I think it was the divine nature of Jesus breaking through and becoming visible in a way that it wasn't normally when he was just walking around. It's who he really was, because the incredible thing about Jesus, the amazing thing about Jesus, is he is absolutely, completely, fully human. He is the Son of Man, and in Hebrew idiom or sort of language, Son of means bearing all the characteristics of. And so to say Son of Man means that he was completely, fully human, but he was also Son of God at the same time. Completely, fully divine with all of the characteristics of God. And that's the mystery of the incarnation, of what happened when Jesus became a person, that he was fully, fully human and fully, fully divine at the same time. And it was kind of like the caterpillar, you know, scrubbing around in the lettuce patch, and somebody pointing to a butterfly, you know, another caterpillar says, "See that? That's where we're going." And the caterpillar, "You're joking, you know, I'm down here in the mud and the leaves. That's incredible. I couldn't possibly." No, surely not. And that was a glimpse of what Jesus was like in his divinity, I think. Incredible, amazing, a real sort of wow experience. And then something else happened. Not only was Jesus turned into something different or appeared as something different, although really the same because it was still him, but two other people turned up, and not actually expected people, Moses and Elijah, and were instantly recognisable, apparently. Or were they? Were they instantly recognisable? Do you think Peter, James and John actually knew, oh yeah, that's, I know him, he's Moses. Was he carrying the tablets of stone so they knew, you know, this is Moses, and Elijah had some sort of, you know, camel hair and whatever prophets carry to show that they're profiting, bank, checkbook maybe. I think they knew because actually they talked about it with Jesus afterwards. Coming down the mountain, what sort of experience do you think, what sort of conversation do you think they had? Excuse me, Jesus, what was all that about? What have we just seen up here? Who were those two people anyway? I don't think they necessarily had name badges on, you know, I'm Moses, I'm Elijah. But they found out who they were talking to Jesus. And they were talking to Jesus, we're told in Luke, about his departure, which he would accomplish in Jerusalem. And the Greek word for departure is exodus. Actually, I'm going to Athens tomorrow, and I've got to do some work in Greece. And you'll see exodus all over the place. It just means the way out. It's exit. You'll see it on all the doors. You see it in the airport and so on. Of course, it's not written like that. It's written in Greek, which is not very helpful unless you read Greek. And if you want to learn to read Greek, then Barry's starting a new set of classes, and that's a good thing to do. But exodus, it means exit. When did Jesus accomplish his exit in Jerusalem? Most people would think that's the cross, that's his crucifixion. I'm not so sure, actually. I wonder, my personal thought is that it might actually be the ascension. That it was the time when, just outside Jerusalem, Jesus on the mountain ascended into heaven and disappeared from this dimension, from this earth, from where we could actually see him and touch him and talk to him physically. And I wonder if his exodus, his exit from this physical, visible realm, was accomplished at the ascension. And I do half wonder whether the two people who turned up at the ascension and said to the disciples, what on earth are you looking at? I wonder if they were Moses and Elijah. It doesn't actually say, it doesn't say they were angels either, they were just two men in white, which I think is interesting. Especially when you think that Jewish tradition is that Moses and Elijah turn up at the end of the age. And was that an end of an age when Jesus went back into heaven? I don't know, I'm just speculating, but I think it's interesting. And it's not necessarily, it doesn't say what the exodus at Jerusalem was, the exit from this realm. But I personally am just sort of attracted to that idea. But interesting that that Moses and Elijah turn up. Why? What were they talking about? Did they want to know? Did they want to talk to Jesus about, we've been thinking about this for about 1,000 years, maybe 2,000 years, not quite sure. Could you just tell us again what's going to happen? Is that what they were talking about? Or were they talking about how Jesus felt about it, and were they encouraging him and supporting him? I don't know. We don't know, do we? It's interesting. Wouldn't you just love to have eavesdropped on that conversation? Incidentally, this is a painting by Raphael, thought to be the last painting that he did. I think it was about 15, 16, somewhere around there. Finished off by one of his... You're going to correct me, aren't you, Nigel? Finished off in 1520 by... Thank you very much. He died in 1520, and one of his students actually finished this off for him. It was supposed to be for the Pope, and then the French Cardinal kind of kept it back and said, I like this, I think I'll have this one. Anyway, interesting. Here's Jesus, and I think this is Moses and Elijah, or maybe it's the other way around, and the three disciples on the mountaintop. So incredible, even more amazing. Jesus transfigured, glistening, glowing like the sun. And then these two heroes of the Old Testament, Moses representing the law, Elijah representing the prophets. And you'll know again and again, there's several times in the New Testament where Jesus explains how the law and the prophets point to him and how there's a connection between what he was doing and the law and the prophets. And so Moses and Elijah representing those two key themes of the Old Testament appear on the mountaintop with him. And how did the disciples react? Actually, there were two reactions to what was going on there. The first is the reaction of the disciples themselves, which we might describe as shock and awe. They were confused. They were exceedingly afraid, it says in verse 6. And then Peter does the typical open mouth, insert foot Peter thing, where he says, three people, looks like they're just about getting ready to go. This is amazing. I'd like to find out more. Why don't we build a tent? Or we'll build three tents, one each, and you can stay in this one, you in this one. Then we'll be able to come and visit you anytime we want and capture this moment, this kind of Kodak moment on the top of the mountain. And then it'll be there, frozen in time, for anybody to come and... How about that, Jesus? And, well, what do you think of that? That was just Peter kind of gabbling, wasn't it? But that wasn't the only reaction. And as Peter was kind of gabbling away, trying to decide what the right response was, there was another reaction to what was happening on the mountain. And it was God's reaction. And God actually intervened in two ways, visibly and audibly. This gets more and more amazing, doesn't it, when you think about what was actually happening on that mountaintop. So God reacted in two ways. First of all, the visible presence of God appeared as a cloud. And if you want to do an interesting study in the Bible, look at the clouds. Just see where that cloud appears. And throughout the Bible, both Old Testament and New Testament, the cloud of God's visible presence and glory appears time after time after time. It's not just, you know, one of these white fluffy things that we see outside in the sky. It's a special cloud. You'll find it turns up, for example, in the wilderness during that other Exodus, the pillar of cloud. And it was the same pillar of cloud that glowed like fire in the night. In the Holy of Holies in the middle of the tabernacle, there was the cloud on the top of Mount Sinai when the law was given, and thunder and lightning, and they were afraid to even touch the mountain. And if anybody touched the mountain, they'd die, because the cloud was there, and God was in the cloud. In the inauguration of the temple, and Solomon's temple, and they launched it all, and they were all singing, and the orchestra was there, and the cloud came and filled the temple so that they couldn't stand. They fell on their faces in the physical presence of God. The baptism of Jesus. The cloud. What cloud was that? This little kind of floaty thing? It was the cloud of the visible presence of God, and the voice of God came out of it. The ascension. He went up in the clouds. It wasn't up into the sky. The visible presence of God appeared around him and absorbed him back into the heavenly dimension. It's the physical presence of God. And then the second coming, the return of Jesus, prophesied in Daniel. He'll come with the clouds. It doesn't mean up there, it means the cloud of God's presence. It's a fantastic whole series of clouds appear in the Bible. And here it is again on the mountaintop, where God is owning this moment, turning up physically present where his Son is in glory, with three men watching. Amazing. And Moses and Elijah there too. And not just this visible presence of the cloud, but then audible. God spoke out of that cloud. And that's happened before in the Bible as well, speaking out of the cloud. Sometimes they thought it was thunder, sometimes they worked out what the words were. Peter, James and John heard the words because it was addressed to them. God was speaking to them on the mountaintop and said, "This is my beloved Son." And there are echoes there, aren't there, of what was said at his baptism. And also a prophecy in Isaiah 42, "My servant who I love, who I put my spirit on." And so this is my beloved Son, and then an instruction, I think maybe particularly to Peter. Listen to him. Shut your mouth, open your ears, listen. And of course, if you look back just into Mark chapter 8, the end of the chapter before, Jesus explaining how he's going to go to Jerusalem and be betrayed and be crucified, and Peter saying, no, that can't happen, no, really. And it's like he breaks in and says, listen to Jesus. That's really important. I think that's amazing, another amazing event happening on the top of the mountain. And the result of all of that, first of all, the disciples are absolutely petrified, particularly when Luke says in Luke 9, verse 34, when they entered the cloud, they became absolutely petrified. and they fell on their faces, it says in Matthew 17, filled with awe. And falling on your face is a fairly standard response to God showing up throughout the Bible and nowadays as well. A common response to being in the special presence of God. But afterwards, after all of this, what happened? They opened their eyes and they saw no one but Jesus only. I think that's a lovely phrase. Focused, concentrating on Jesus. It's all about Jesus. All of Christianity, all of our faith, all of the things we're doing, discipleship, outreach, worship, it's all about Jesus. And to see no one but Jesus only, I think that's a real goal. That's something that we could think about. Is that right for us, to focus on Jesus only? Or is it? What was that actually all about? Peter reflected on it. Peter thought about it. And later on, when he was writing letters to people, he actually wrote about this very event and explained what he thought was going on. And it's here in Peter's second letter, first chapter, verses 16 to 18. He's explained to people, we haven't made this up. We're not following cleverly devised myths when we made known to you the power and coming of our Lord Jesus Christ. But we were eyewitnesses of his majesty. We actually saw his majesty, what we were singing about in that song just a moment ago. We were eyewitnesses of his majesty. But when he received honour and glory from God the Father, and the voice was borne to him by the majestic glory, that's the cloud, this is my beloved Son with whom I am well pleased. We heard this voice born from heaven, for we were with him on the holy mountain. Peter's saying, that was incredible, that was amazing. What was happening there, we were eyewitnesses of his majesty, and he received honour and glory from God the Father. I think John spoke about this too. Peter, James and John were there in the beginning of John's gospel. You know, we beheld his glory. We actually saw it physically. Incredible. For the disciples, it was a revelation of his majesty. Who is this person we're following? We've been spending time walking around with. Who is he really? I bet they were thinking that all the time. And then they got a glimpse. And then they got an explanation from God. This is my beloved Son. And then an instruction, listen to him. But I think there was a purpose for Jesus too. He received honour and glory from God the Father. God was identifying with him, saying, yes, Son, I'm with you. You are my Son. I do love you. And I think he was really encouraged. And maybe Moses and Elijah encouraging him too, because he was going to do something incredible, something amazing in Jerusalem, not very far away. So what an amazing event. Unique, nothing like it before or since. Maybe a little hint of it when Moses came down from the mountain and his face was shining after being in the presence of God. But that was reflection. This was active shining. This was like the sun, the source of light and energy. And I just wonder whether you would have liked to have been there. Whether you would have liked to have been, if there were four people on the mountain, you know, Peter, James, John and me. Would you have liked to have seen that, to have experienced that, to have heard that? I would. I mean, I think absolutely. If there was if they were selling tickets, I would have that. I would want to be there to see what Peter, James and John saw and experienced. But what happened next? After all of that incredible experience, something else happened. And there's a second part to this story, and these two things are completely connected. Because, and I'm going to read or look at the version here from Luke, because the Mark version is a bit long, but just it's more summarised in Luke. We've got something else happen. The next day, so they did actually spend the night on the mountain, and as I say, they probably talked about it. When they came down from the mountain, a great crowd met him. A man from the crowd called out, "Teacher, I beg you, look upon my son, my only child." A spirit seizes him, and he suddenly cries out. It convulses him until he foams. This really intense word, it shatters him. Just imagine, you can sense the anguish of this man, can't you? Oh, Jesus, my son. I begged your disciples to cast it out and they couldn't. Jesus said, "Faithless and perverse generation, how long am I to be with you and bear with you? Bring your son here." And while he was coming, the demon tore him and convulsed him. But Jesus rebuked the unclean spirit, healed the boy and gave him back his father, and they were all astonished the majesty of God. There's something else. After this amazing event up the mountain, they literally come down to earth with a big bump. Meanwhile, back in the valley, a very different situation has been unfolding. Something very different is going on, which actually also ends up being an amazing event. They were all amazed, but in rather a different way from what was happening on the mountaintop. What we had was a really, really difficult situation here, characterized by confusion and conflict. Mark says in verse 14, there was a great crowd surrounding the disciples, and the scribes were all arguing with them. It wasn't just happening quietly in some corner somewhere. It was characterized by failure and impotence. They were not able. I brought them, but they couldn't. They couldn't help. And we've got here a situation which looks on the one hand like epilepsy. You know, he's foaming at the mouth and he's having convulsions and he's torn around. But the explanation is that this has a spiritual source. It's oppression by a demon. And whatever you think about spiritual realities, it's either one or the other or both. And I think the Bible says quite clearly in this case, it was both. You know, we might say, well, with modern medical science, we'd explain it in a different way. Well, the Bible says sometimes physical sickness has a spiritual reason. And here's an example where it's just absolutely explicit. So take it or leave it, depends on how you view the Bible. My view is, as a scientist, why not? You know, it could have two reasons, couldn't it? So we've got this very, very difficult situation and real challenge for the disciples. Why was it a challenge? Because it was within their scope. It was part of their calling to deal with this. If you look just a couple of chapters earlier, in Mark chapter 6, Jesus had already called his disciples and sent them out and given them authority to deal with just this sort of thing. And they did. If you read in Mark chapter 6, verses 12 and 13 there, they went out and they preached the gospel and they cast out demons and they healed the sick. They've done this before. Without Jesus there, Jesus sent them out and they did it out there. So it's part of, you know, what they're normally used to doing. Amazing still to be doing it, but they had done it before. So why not this time? What was different? Why couldn't they? And I think that was the source of the confusion and the frustration and the impotence, because they knew they should have been able to do this. Jesus had already given them everything they needed to do it. So it was a very, very difficult situation going on down in the valley. Enter Jesus. And I think, you know, I wish we were filming this or showing, you know, here's the amazing transforming occasion or event. Jesus turns up. And when Jesus turns up, he does three things. First of all, he expresses disappointment. You should have dealt with this. And I think we have to sometimes just take that on the chin. He said to the disciples, you know, oh, and some fairly strong words. But he doesn't just express disappointment. He expected the disciples to cope. He does something. Jesus intervenes, and he brought healing and deliverance. And for me, the key phrase, as a father, I just identify with this man. You know, there's nothing worse than seeing your children suffer and not being able to do anything about it, and going somewhere to try and get help, and it doesn't work. Doesn't that just tear you up inside? And the last part of what Jesus did, he delivered the demon, he healed the boy, and what did he do? Gave him back to his father. And that just does something inside me as a father. For me, the story is not about the demon, it's not about the disciples, it's about the daddy. And I often watch films with my kids, you know, and I say to them, just wait, somewhere in this film there's a daddy moment. And most films have something where it's about the daddy. And you look for it, and especially if you are a father, or you want to be a father, or you're going to be a father, then that's something to look out for. And Jesus gave the boy back to his father. Fantastic. So he did that, and then he explained. So what's going on, they said to Jesus. Why couldn't we do this? And you'll find two explanations in Mark. He says you need prayer, and in the margin some people have written in, and fasting. And Matthew 17 talks about faith. Faith, little faith that can move big mountains. You know, there's things that we need to deal with these situations. Now, let me wrap up fairly quickly. A huge contrast. a huge contrast between what was happening up on the mountain and what was happening down in the valley. And I think Nigel might have been a bit disappointed that I only showed half of Raphael's picture before. And I wonder if he was sitting there thinking, he's missed a bit. And maybe some of you other educated people were as well. Because what Raphael was doing is he's got all this fantastic stuff happening out up here. Meantime, down in the valley, here are the nine disciples here, and here's the boy with his father and everybody else shouting and getting all uptight. And there's a real contrast between peace and joy and light and worship on the mountaintop and all of this kind of tension and anguish down below. And we have to recognise these two things were actually happening at the same time. Where would you rather have been? Up on the mountain with Jesus and the three, or down in the valley with the nine, with the father and the boy and the scribes and the crowd? I think that's a false question. I think that's a mistake to say you could either choose to be up there or you could choose to be down there. Which would you rather? Because I think we're called to both. These are both happening at the same time. We don't have to decide whether to be up on the mountaintop or down in the valley. These are both occurring at the same time. And it's important for us to recognise you can't live on the mountaintop. Jesus took them up there, and this amazing thing happened, and then he took them down again. And he went with them into the valley, into the place of conflict, into the place of failure, into the place of impotence, into the place of anguish. And he took them there too. And the important thing for us to recognise is that special occasions do occur, but they're rare. But daily life is daily. The normal, ordinary grind, the difficult stuff, happens all the time. The special things don't happen very often. They do happen, praise God for that, but they don't always happen. So, this brings us back to our rhyme. Let me finish with the children's rhyme where we started. But I don't just want to talk about Richard Plantagenet anymore. What I'd rather do, because it's more important, isn't it, to talk about Jesus. And I think that actually Jesus is a little bit, just a little bit like the grand old Duke of York. Because he wants us to experience both the mountaintop and the valley. He leads us up to the top of the hill and he leads us down again, just like the grand old Duke of York. Both of those are important for us. To have a clear revelation of the divine nature of Jesus, to be witnesses of his majesty. That's important. It's also important for us to be fulfilling our calling on earth, in the valley, to preach, to heal and deliver. And in fact, you can't do one without the other. They go together. We need to be obedient to the leading of Jesus. We need to follow him wherever he goes. And there's another children's song, which you might know, which I used to sing when I was little, and I used to sing it with my kids too. And it's this, follow, follow, I will follow Jesus. Anywhere, everywhere, I will follow him. Follow, follow, I will follow Jesus. Anywhere he leads me, I will follow him. And it's pretty tough words. That's a big commitment. Anywhere, everywhere, except China. Anywhere, everywhere, except places where it's difficult. No, anywhere, everywhere, I will follow him. And of course, this is discipleship, one of our current themes here in this church. Follow Jesus wherever. We need to be responding to his invitation to come with him to the mountaintop, if he calls us, so that when we're up, we're up. Be there, if that's where he's calling us to be, to those rare special occasions of experiencing the special presence of God. It happens sometimes. Sometimes on retreats, sometimes on weekends away, sometimes at Spring Harvest or Word Alive or those kinds of special places where you find the special presence of God. Well, let's enjoy that. Let's be in that when it happens. But let's recognise that it doesn't happen all the time. When we're down, and I don't mean depressed, I mean when we're down in the valley, we need to be down as well. We need to face the challenges of the valley with prayer and with faith, fulfilling our calling to engage with the world in that gritty, grotty daily life that we all have to lead, including preaching the gospel and healing the sick and dealing with spiritual oppression. We need to be where he's calling us to be today, whether that's up or down, not wishing we were somewhere else. Because if we expect to be only in one place or the other, we'll be disappointed. We'll be like the men of the Duke of York, who are only halfway up, and they're neither up nor down. And that's really not a very good place to be. We shouldn't be halfway Christians, neither up nor down. We should be not either on the mountaintop or in the valley. We've got to be both and. And that's our calling. So I think we should not dismiss those or deny those special moments. But let's not live for them either. We need to take the revelation from the mountaintop into the reality of the valley. Keeping both in proper perspective, not being so heavenly minded that we're no earthly good, but not being so earthbound that we forget the majesty of Jesus, who he is, and the commission that he's given us. It's quite a challenge, but if we follow Jesus, then when we're up, we'll be up, and when we're down, we'll be down.